your handout. If you don't have a handout, this year will be hard. I want to start, though, by elaborating on something the rabbi said to explain why I think we have to talk about these topics in public. It used to be that things that the rabbi didn't talk about in public never got spoken about, and that we could control within our own community not what was said when a topic was raised, but what topics were spoken about. The rise of the internet has, in my view, changed the halacha calculus on many topics. As I was preparing for this year, in whatever that room is called, I went on Google and I typed birth control in Jewish law. And there are, thank God, more than a million entries on Google. I didn't even use the word halacha. So what we see from this is that if we don't discuss topics, it's not that they're not discussed. It's that everybody discusses them, whether they know what's going on or they don't know what's going on, whether they know any Jewish law, whether they don't know any Jewish law, whether they have any sense at all of what's going on in our community or in any of the science or can read Hebrew or Aramaic. I'm no longer of the view that there are any halachic topics that we should not address in public, because there are no halachic topics that are not in fact addressed in public, and that this is itself sad. The rabbis thought Ein Dorshin Barayos. They thought there were certain things you shouldn't speak about in a public forum, and maybe that's a better universe. Maybe that is a better universe where certain topics got spoken about one at a time to each and every person, but we don't live in that universe anymore, and whether we think that's a better universe or a worse universe is unimportant. We are living in a society where access to the internet is a norm, and the notion that if we don't talk about birth control and halacha, people will ask is itself a quaint notion. If we don't talk about birth control and halacha, people will read it on the Wikipedia page that deals with it. So to me, I've become more committed in the last decade to not having topics that I don't talk about, because I simply don't believe we can control the dialogue anymore. We can participate in the dialogue, we can lead the dialogue by saying the most intelligent, thoughtful, learned things, but we can't squelch the conversation, because the internet has made conversation squelching hard even for the government of the United States, and certainly is very hard for contemporary halachic authority. So I'm sure that there are people out there who say we shouldn't talk about these topics in public, and I think that's probably right. We shouldn't talk about these topics in public, but I know that if I don't talk about these topics in public, it's not that they won't be spoken about in public. They'll be spoken about by all sorts of people who have both less of a command of the sources, not that I have a great command of the sources, less knowledge of our community. So I'm committed to talking in public about all sorts of topics that my grandparents were committed to not ever talking about. I remember in 11th grade, when I was a student in MCA, my 11th grade rabbi had the only halachic conversation I ever had about birth control and halacha, and he had it with us one at a time in 11th grade as we were prepared to graduate from high school. And that was a very worthwhile conversation. But I lived in the pre-modern era. I went to high school before the internet. So the only way we found out about certain aspects of Jewish law were from our Rebbeim. That's just no longer the case. So we either talk about things in public, or we run the risk that we learn about them by typing on Google, birth control in Jewish law. Most times, when the rabbis discussed a topic that was governed by a Torah law, the rabbis said, don't just do the Torah minimum, do it more than the minimum. So the Torah requires that you eat a kezayit of matzah Pesach night, and then they crafted a seder. How many kezayitim of matzah do we eat at the seder? Mom, this is not a hard question. This year's only going to get harder than that. How many times do we eat matzah at the Seder? Three. That's right. And you know why the rabbis did this? Because they thought some of you might not be so precise, and you might not eat it kedayis the first time, and you might not eat kedayis the second time. So they figured they'd give you three different times to fulfill an important mitzvah.
And can you put them all together?
And the rabbis said you have to say Shema every day. And Shabbos morning, how many times do we say Shema? Most of us say it three times. We say it once in Karbanos, once in Shema, and once in Kedusha. It's a common motif of rabbinic regulation that when you come to a Torah commandment, the rabbi said, if the Torah says do it once, you should do it more than once because you might be thinking about soccer or your children the first time and you won't get it right. If you do it a few times, eventually you'll get it right. The mitzvah of Purim Ravuah is different. The Torah says a person, a couple, should seek to have a boy and a girl, and that they should work diligently and do their very best to have the minimum of one boy and one girl. How much more than a boy and a girl should a couple have? The rabbi said you should have as many as you can handle. I should see peikecha until your hands are full of children. Some people, you see, their hands are full of two, and they should stop. Some people, their hands are full of six. And some people you see effortlessly raising, not just a basketball team or a baseball team, but a football team without any difficulty at all, and their hands never seem full. The rabbis recognize that child rearing is an art. And people are gifted at different levels. They didn't say, like they said by matzah, have six. Triple this year, or by other things, double it, have four. The rabbi said, we recognize that children are different. And while everybody should have the minimum, how much more than the minimum you're supposed to have is a determination that's personal to you. You should have as many as you can handle. No more. No more. And it's important to understand why. The mitzvah is not to have children. We're not fish. The mitzvah is to raise children. And you don't fulfill the mitzvah of Pru Urvu by having them. You fulfill the mitzvah of Pru Urvu by raising them to adulthood until they themselves have children. This is extremely important to understand. The mitzvah is to raise them. It's not to have them. And in that model, you now readily understand much that's about to come up in the construct of birth control. Please.
Just want to know, you're giving this talk to a more modern Orthodox group of people. You're giving this talk to a Hasidic group of people. How would you justify that?
True. It's in the sources. I don't know. Thank God. We come from the same Gemara and the same postgame. It's clear that the mitzvah is to raise children because when I have children and they die in my lifetime, I have not fulfilled the mitzvah. And when I have children and they have children, I fulfill the mitzvah. The mitzvah is clearly not to have them. The mitzvah is to raise them. So too, the Shulchan Aruch says, for example, in a time of famine, I can delay having more children to make sure the children that I have are well fed. So everybody asks, post-gum asks, why should I do that? The answer, of course, is that feeding the children that I have is a fulfillment of the mitzvah of Pru Urvu. We'll come to that. You want to go all the way to the end at the beginning? And this is an explanation as well for the question in Pirkei Avot. Pirkei Avos says, Ben Shmona Esrei L'chuppa. 18 is a good age to get married, and under no circumstances should you let your 20th year pass without being married. So I just want to note for the record, I was engaged before I was 21, and I was married slightly after I was 21. I'm 47 now, and I've been married for 26 years. Who else was married young? Any 21-year-olds married? Okay, good. I found it to be very worthwhile and wonderful. I was glad I married the young. But it's unusual in our community. All the poskim ask the following questions. It's a head scratcher. When is a boy obligated in mitzvot? 13. I don't understand. The Beis Shmuel says, shouldn't we say to people, when you get bar mitzvah, you should get married? Why wait? And you might say at first glance, it's because, well, you can't have children when you're 13. But that's wrong. Of course you can. Just look in other communities. It's easy to have a child when you're 13. The answer that the poskim give is because, well, when you're 13, you can have them. You do a bad job raising them. And Chazal said, wait to get married and have children until you are at a stage in which you can do what? Raise them. So everybody agrees that the mitzvah is not to have them in the biological sense of the word. The mitzvah is to raise them to adulthood in a context that works. That's why we discourage 13-year-olds who would run to perform this mitzvah if we told them they could. We nonetheless tell them you may not. I'm a pacer, so I'm just going to bring this back a little bit. Who would run to perform this mitzvah if we could, we tell them, no, you must wait. Because the mitzvah is not to procreate. The mitzvah is to raise children to adulthood. This is the fundamental view that's found in the Rishonim. As far as I'm aware of, there is no halachic authority who argues with this view. Now, there are, in the reality of the world that we live in, conversations about how many can you handle. And there's even some conversation that we'll come to about methods of birth control. But it's extremely important to understand the yesod, the principle. The first principle is that you do not fulfill the mitzvah of pru or vu merely by having children. The mitzvah of pru or vu is to raise the children to adulthood. What flows from that is an obvious rabbinic concern that having too many children will endanger some of the older children for the sake of having younger children. And the rabbis recognize more or less that having children has no exact shiur. It's not like shaking a lulav or eating matzah or davening, where the rabbi said, shake a lulav twice every day on Sukkot, or the rabbi said with regards to davening, daven three times a day, or have three pieces of matzah, or many other commandments. Here the rabbi said the Torah has a minimum of a boy and a girl. Everybody should aspire to have as many children as they can handle, and how many exactly you could handle is not assigned a specific number. It recognizes the diversity of human ability to handle children. Very complicated. That's a very complicated question. The next matter... Sure.
Clarify. You said that if a parent loses a child, then they haven't been telling this before. So what if they're already married? You also said that the mitzvah is to raise them until they get married.
And this is an elaborate conversation. You can fulfill the mitzvah of pru or vu if your children have children and then they die. I don't want to spend too much time on the details of this conversation, but the answer is you do not fulfill the mitzvah of pru or vu merely by having children.
And what happens where there's a couple that, you know, have, let's say, boy after boy after boy, which to a stage where more than just a baker dove, and
there's no license to stop having children until you have a boy or a girl within reason. There's no obligation to, for example, to get divorced and marry somebody else. And there's certainly no obligation to use artificial means. But there's a mitzvah to continue to procreate so long as the next child doesn't endanger the existence of this child. I have a lot to cover, though, so... No. Adoption is, according to some halachic authorities, a bigger mitzvah than having children, but it's a totally different mitzvah. In general, when you want to compare mitzvot, should I have a child or be a soldier in the Israeli army? It's very hard to do these calculations because you're comparing different mitzvot. Adopting, taking care of a Jewish child who doesn't have a mommy and a daddy, according to many halachic authorities, is the mitzvah of hatzalat nefesh, saving the life of a person. That sounds more important than the fulfillment of the mitzvah of pruvah, but it's a different mitzvah. It's not the same mitzvah. It's a different mitzvah. The second conversation that we need to have is one that we hinted at before, which is, what's the appropriate time to start this mitzvah? And here we need to move away from the mitzvah of pruvah to move into a more general construct. When I have a mitzvah to say that has a specific time frame for fulfilling it, when in that specific time frame should I fulfill the mitzvah? So, for example, it says, Uvayom Hashmini Yimol B'sar Olato. On the eighth day, a child is obligated in the mitzvah of Mila. When in the eighth day? Should I do it first thing in the morning?
Yes.
Why? So we have a principle of the reason Makdim in the mitzvah. It's best to do mitzvah early. What about if my parents can't show up at 5:27 in the morning when the sun rises? Should I do it then? I can do it later. What about if sun rises at 5:27 and the first chakras isn't until 6:30? And even the 6:30 chakras, most people come only half awake. And I want to do the bris when the mole is not trying to open his eyes because I want him to look closely while he's working. Can I delay the bris? The poskim say, of course. And I'll explain to you why. When the Torah gives us a time frame for doing a mitzvah, the principles that push me to do the mitzvah earlier in the time frame rather than later in the time frame are secondary. They're things like Zrizim Makdim in LaMitzvah and other secondary principles. By routine, we push off those principles for many good reasons. So I wake up in the morning in Atlanta, Georgia, and I push off davening the moment I wake up when the sun is out so that I can daven with a minyan. Sometimes I push off the mitzvah so that I can daven with a minyan of people that I like, or a minyan of davens that's just the right speed for me, or so that I can shower before I go to minyan so I not be a distraction to my fellow mitzpalim, or any number of other reasons. In general, when I have a time frame for doing a mitzvah, the rabbis did not scream in a loud voice to do the mitzvah immediately. They instead said, I can delay doing the mitzvah until a suitable time period arises for doing the mitzvah, but I shouldn't wait too long, because if I wait too long, you know what could happen? I could run out of time. This principle is one that we already see in the mitzvah of Pruah Ravuh. This is why the rabbis did not say, when you turn bar mitzvah, you know what you should do?
Have a baby.
Have a baby. Rav Yitzchok Elchanan Spector writes in one of his brief autobiographical notes that his parents were very poor, and to save money, they had his ofruf and his bar mitzvah on the same Shabbos. But most of us would look at that and say, no, no, no. It's a terrible mistake to encourage your children to get married at the age of 13. And the reason why it's a terrible mistake to encourage your children to get married at the age of 13 is because they have a whole life to have children. And 13 is not a good time to fulfill this mitzvah, just like 5:27 in the morning is not a good time to daven shacharis because you're half asleep. The mitzvah of Pruah Ravuh is, in that sense, no different than any other mitzvah asay. It has a time frame. The time frame is from your bar mitzvah until the point that you die. But that time frame is incorrect, because while men can fulfill the mitzvah of Pruah Ravuh on a biological level for an extended period of time, women cannot. Women cease being able to fulfill the mitzvah of Pruah Ravuh in their 40s, and thus you have to allocate a reasonable amount of time to fulfill the mitzvah of Pruah Ravuh. And thus we come to a central real-world conversation about birth control, which is, the younger you are when you marry, the easier it is halachically to delay having children, and the easier it is halachically to space your children. Because having the proper number of children that are necessary for you is a different conversation if you marry when you're 20, and if you marry when you're 28, or if you marry when you're 32. Because you just start running out of time. And this is itself a very important conversation. Having children is, in that regard, no different than any other mitzvah aseh. Right? As with any other mitzvah aseh, it has a window that you can perform it. Within the window of performance, there's no particular rabbinic insistence that you perform it at this point or at that point. The rabbis insisted that you should seek to perform the mitzvah of Pru Revu at the time at which the children that will be born will be raised properly and come out well. But everybody recognizes that children are not like pizzas. They can't just be ordered and then they appear. It takes a certain amount of time, and the amount of time it takes is different from person to person, and time to time and place to place. So it's a very complicated conversation, because even after a couple decides to have a child, children just don't appear poof. They take an extended period of time and a certain amount of hashgacha and prayer, and things don't always work out the way they are. But it's important to understand that having a child, the mitzvah of Pru Revu, is a mitzvah aseh min haTorah. The Torah obligation, like any other mitzvah aseh min haTorah, when a person says, this is an inconvenient time for me to fulfill the mitzvah, or worse, they say, if I fulfill the mitzvah now, the mitzvah will not come out properly, because I'm not in the right time frame to fulfilling the mitzvah, within reason, that's an appropriate reason to delay having children. But you can't use this all the time, because if you use this all the time, you quickly discover that you run out of time to have a reasonable number of children. So this is just a central aspect of family planning. Family planning, from a halakhic perspective, requires a plan. The plan has to have a starting point at which people get married. It has to have a conversation among the two of them, a husband and a wife, about when they're going to start having children. A continuous reevaluation of how many children do the two of them think that they can cope with. A desire to have as many children as they reasonably can cope with, and no more, but also and no less. And then implementing that plan into place. Sometimes this requires facing children. Sometimes this requires delaying having children when the marriage begins, because we sadly enough live in a time and a place where divorce is very easy and common, and couples want to wait a short period of time to make sure that they're in a marriage that's going to last. And they don't want to have a child and then discover that they actually hate each other. Which, by the way, you see happens all the time. I serve as a dayan in a bez, and I can't tell you how many gittin I've been misadar where the woman's pregnant. I can't say how many gittin I've been misadar, hundreds of gittin, and 10% of the time the woman's expecting. You have to be careful. When you get newly married, getting married is not a commitment that this marriage will last forever as a matter of halacha. Jewish law recognizes that people get divorced. But having a child really, really, really is a commitment that you're going to stick this marriage through for as long as you reasonably can. And you don't want to sit down to have children until you're pretty sure that what you've got is a marriage that's going to last. That's part of the mitzvah to say of raising your children. It's making sure that there's a mommy and a daddy who are going to do their very best to stick together. Couples would be well served waiting a little while before they get married, to make sure that they expect to stay married before they have children. You have to apply that in different societies. This is less true, for example, in a Chabad community in Williamsburg. How come?
Support from the
community. No. I'm sorry? Taboo. Divorce is taboo. People hate each other and stay married in some communities. Meaning you can live in a society where whether you like each other or you hate each other, you stay married. In which case, you don't have to check out if this is the right person for you, because this is the person you're stuck with, whether you like them or not. You might as well have children with them, because you're going to be stuck with them their whole life. That's just the way it goes. No, you step into, meaning, if you step into a community where the divorce rate is, let's say, 1 in 1,000. Look, I've seen the Dionys book for Vilna from 1837 to 1940. This is the Dionys book for Vilna. Vilna, Dionys book, governed a community of hundreds of thousands. From 1837 to 1940, there were 103 divorces in Vilna. In that more than 100-year period, one every 3 years, give or take. So you could derive from that all the Jews loved each other under all circumstances, or you could derive from that the truth, which is the Beis Din and the Vilna Beis Din said, you can't get divorced, go back. Which is what they said. And the only time they permitted divorce was when the case file read something like, husband came home and wife hit him with a baseball bat, or wife came home and husband seeks to drown her in the local river. All other cases, and we see dozens of them in Vilna, the husband came in and said, I hate my wife. And wife came in and said, I hate my husband. And the Dayanim said, gosh, that's so interesting. Go home. go home. And they went home and had children. Because if you're home, you might as well have children. It's something to do. But it's very important to understand, that's not our society. In our society, when husband hates wife and wife hates husband, they get divorced. And since they get divorced, you have to be very careful to make sure that you're not having children in a time and a place where it's bad for the children. So it's important to emphasize that fact over and over and over again, which is the mitzvah is not to have children. The mitzvah is to raise children in an environment that's conducive to raising little children full of Yiras Shemayim, religiosity, Torah, and mitzvot. That's not a small task. It's very hard to raise children. It's hard in this world. It's just hard. And you have to have children at a time that you're capable of doing an excellent, good job raising them. So the mitzvah of Pru'urvu is the mitzvah to have and raise children in Torah and mitzvot. It can be delayed for the sake of making sure that you're better served having them at a better time in a better place. Under no circumstances can you delay more than a reasonable amount of time such that you can have a full spectrum of children. And you have to make sure that you have a plan for having as many children as you reasonably can. There's no exact minimum given. Not like matzah or lulav or Hanukkah candles. The rabbi said you should have as many as you can cope with. Now we're going to totally shift gears and we're going to talk more nitty gritty about methods of birth control. So too, in the good old days, methods of birth control were never discussed because these were public shiurim that were immodest. But again, the world has changed. And everything immodest is available on the internet. Many things are incredibly immodest and available on the internet, and certainly conversations about birth control seem tame in comparison to what's available on the internet. As a matter of halacha, there are three, or maybe four, distinctly different methods of birth control. The first is a physical barrier used by a man. Physical barriers used by a man to prevent contraception are almost always usur, and should never be used other than in exigent circumstances. There are exigent cases where a physical barrier used by the man as a method of birth control might be permitted, such as, for example, a person who has HIV, or other unusual, peculiar, anomalous cases. Where otherwise we would say an abortion is permitted. But by the routine, a physical barrier used by a man to prevent a method of contraception is significantly frowned on among halachic authorities. According to many halachic authorities, it's a Torah prohibition. According to other halachic authorities, it's a severe rabbinic prohibition. Bottom line is that a method of contraception that's a physical barrier used by the man is an unacceptable method of family planning, within the halachic community. Second method of contraception is a physical barrier used by the woman, what the Mishnayos call a moch, which we might socially, colloquially translate as a diaphragm, although it's not an extremely accurate term.
Is there a difference between using a diaphragm, using a femidome, or using a punch?
Maybe. It's a good question. We'll come back to it. This is a dispute between Rabbeinu Tam and Rashi. The Mishnayos and Yevamos tell us Shlosha Nashim Mishtamshim B'moch. Three women are allowed to use a diaphragm. And Rabbeinu Tam and Rashi argue right there about whether the proper way to translate the Hebrew is three women must use a diaphragm and all other women may, or these three women may use the diaphragm, implying that all other women may not. And this dispute is not firmly resolved in the Shulchan Aruch or in the codes, and it remains an open dispute as a matter of halacha as to whether a physical method of birth control like a diaphragm is permissible only in a case of serious need, like a woman who's nursing, who she conceives will have to prematurely wean her child, or a diaphragm as a normally accepted method of birth control is completely proper. A better hachra is that a diaphragm should only be used as a method of birth control in situations in which there isn't a significant halachic need for birth control. It's a method of birth control that's halachically frowned on, although much less frowned on than a male barrier. The preferred method of birth control, and then there's another method of birth control, which is tube tying. Tube tying was called in the language of the Chachamim Sirus Be'isha, and tube tying as a matter of halacha is frowned on more severely than the use of a diaphragm, but is only permissible in a situation where there's a significant health need to the woman. Now, this has been a little bit modified in contemporary times because they no longer tie tubes, they now plug them. You'll find a smattering of halachic authorities who say, since the current method of tube tying can readily be undone, it's much less severe than it was in the old days. But still, the preferred method of birth control, one that is without any technical halachic problems, is the pill. A hormonal method of birth control is, without any doubt, the most halachically proper method of birth control for a couple to use as they space children, or even as they delay having their first child. Furthermore, I'll make a Taras HaMishpacha observation, which is there is no reason that a couple that uses the pill as a form of birth control has to use a 28-cycle pill pack. You can easily use a 35 or 42 or 49-cycle pill pack and thus reduce the number of days of abstinence imposed in a marriage. Although I don't want to spend too much time dealing with Taras HaMishpacha, in fifth grade I learned that 13 out of 28 is a much bigger number than 13 out of 42. And as far as I know, the math has not changed. And there's no reason, if you're going to go on the pill as a method of birth control, that you go on a 28-day cycle. There are many good halachic reasons that if you're going to be on the pill in the course of a marital relationship, that you have a longer than a 28-day cycle. It's easy to craft a pill pack with a 49-day cycle. See your OBGYN, but I could show you myself right now, in truth, if we needed to. So I just want to make a Taras HaMishpacha observation. The only people who find the observance of Taras HaMishpacha when they're newly married to be rewarding are people who write books about it. Everybody else, and no, it's just the truth. The observance of Taras HaMishpacha is hard. I remember 20 years ago when I was sitting L'Chag Ba'Omer at a Bible professor's house, Moshe Bernstein, Professor Moshe Bernstein of Yeshiva College. And every L'Chag Ba'Omer we would have a game. It was a very rabbinic game. The game was that you could take one mitzvah out min Torah, and there'd only be 612. What mitzvah would you take out? Fascinating. Rabbi Lamb once said it was the single most interesting reflection on your Torah personality that he'd ever encountered. And I, of course, joke that you could immediately see the difference between the singles and the married, because the singles took out philosophically bothersome mitzvot. Killing a malek. Everybody has their philosophically bothersome mitzvah, and all the marrieds took out Taras Mishvah. It was easy to see the difference between the theory and the practice of Judaism. But the truth is that the observance of Taras Mishvah is hard. It's hard. We live in a sexual society in which matters of sexuality, marital and non-marital, are spoken about all the time. It's not good, it's bad. But it's the universe we live in, and encouraging marital sexuality is an appropriate thing. It used to be that there was a time and a place where the poskim discouraged marital sexuality in general. But, you know, Rav Moshe writes, Rav Moshe Feinstein, who was not the hippest of the hip, writes that even though the Gemara tells us Ona is Tam El Chasam is Tam Echad B'Shvua, that the custom among rabbinic people was that they only lived with their spouse once a week. In one of the few times he reflects on his own practice, he says, the practice of Talmidei Chachamim in his day, and he says this is his practice as well, is to live together twice a week, because we live in a dor parut. Now you scratch your head and say, excuse me, I don't understand. Just because you live in a dor parut, in an immodest generation, how does this affect you? So Rav Moshe was no dummy. He understood that the seeing of sexuality out there in the world inspires an interest in marital sexuality. And it's important that the interest in sexuality that's marital be fulfilled in a marriage. And we might say, well, we're all from Jews and nobody would ever step outside of their marriage. But, you know, here I also sit on a bezdin. And I see the world that we live in, where people who wear kippot and wear shadels nonetheless step out of their marriage. And it's very important that people be encouraged to have a sexually satisfying marriage, because we live in a time and a place where every sexual wish can be fulfilled. You know, I hesitate to step into the phone booths here in the UK, because they plaster the phone booths with ads that I can't look at. And you know, I'm a law professor. I live in a very secular world, and still the ads in the phone booths here are pornographic. So we have to be careful here. Our practice ought to be to encourage marital sexuality to the fullest amount permitted by halacha, in recognition of the fact that non-marital sexuality is so readily available. So when we reflect on methods of birth control, we see that the pill is the preferred method of birth control. It's not physically invasive in the act, in the marital act at all. A diaphragm is the second most preferred method of birth control, but not to be used without clear license. Tube tying is next on the list, and a physical barrier used by the man is next on the list, and the last three all require a clear, explicit, and direct halachic license. Please.
You've nicked out a coil.
Oh, you're right. An IUD. I'll tell you why I left it out, because I'm the wrong person to ask. My view is that an IUD is an early abortion, because an IUD does not prevent conception, it prevents implantation. And since it prevents implantation rather than conception, I'm uncomfortable with it. The Israeli halachic authorities are completely in disagreement with me, and they think an IUD is no different than the pill. So, I'm sorry? So the hormonal IUDs are just like pills. But the non-hormonal IUDs, which are what they call the copper IUDs, are prevent implantation and don't prevent conception. So I'm very uncomfortable with them. But in truth, most of my chaverim and all of my rebbeim do not agree with me. So when I talk about it, I wait until somebody asks before I answer, because I'm hesitant to voice my view as strict, but I'm hesitant to answer your question without voicing my view.
People are more comfortable about
the Miranda. The Miranda is just a hormonal IU. It's just a steady pill. It's like a pill patch.
Right.
Instead of taking a pill, by the way, you can take a patch. These are all just methods of delivery of hormones.
What about male hormones that might?
So the male hormone pills have not been well developed at all. There was just a New York Times article on it. So since it's not well established what's out there, there's no point in halakhically addressing them.
I'm willing to give a view on the downside of the pill in terms of the health.
No, it's not my job. meaning, you know, you've got to learn. What are your limits? People shouldn't do things that are medically bad for them. That goes without saying. My intuition from reading literature is that most women in most situations should not find the pill to be difficult to use. Most women in most situations. Every person is their own person. Few people are most, but most of us are most, in fact. Other hands up. Okay. The third issue is the issue that you touched on of what's going on in other communities. And this is a theological question. Look, 75 years ago, a third of the Jewish community was wiped out after the Holocaust. And there's a sense among halakha communities of what we call make hay while the sun shines, which is we're living in a golden time and a golden place. And in a golden time, in a golden place, what you're supposed to do is make gold. And what's more precious than Jewish children? So you should have a lot of them. And this approach is completely proper. This approach says, look, this is an opportunity. Children are wonderful. The more you have, the more wonderful they are. And you should stretch yourself as much as you can to have as many children as you reasonably can. And I'm not opposed to that approach. I also recognize that this isn't for everybody. And since this approach isn't for everybody, and it's a meta issue rather than a practical issue, you don't answer shilas that people ask about how they should conduct themselves by making a hashkafic point. So even though I very much believe that Takamat Medina Yisrael is Reshit Tzmichat Gulatenu, and I think everybody would be better off living in Israel. Notwithstanding that fact, when somebody asks me if I think they should make Aliyah, I peer closely at them and tell them what I think is in their best interest. My hashkafa doesn't interfere in my role as a halakhic authority. And when somebody comes to me to talk about having children, even though I think you have to make hay while the sun shines and more children are better, nonetheless, it's obvious as a shul rabbi that there are some people who should stop at two. And there are some people who, in truth, in my heart of hearts, think should never marry. So you have to, you can't let the notion of making hay while the sun shines interfere with the fact that different people have different levels of competence. And different levels of competence reflect different realities. And of course, this is a wonderful opportunity to have as many children as we can handle, and people should be encouraged to stretch and have more than they can handle. Every person is their own person. And a theology about Am Yisrael no more motivates me to tell you to move to Israel than it motivates me to tell you to have another child. It might motivate me to give a sermon saying you all should move to Israel, but that doesn't mean you specifically. And it might motivate me to give a sermon saying we all should have more children, but that doesn't mean you specifically. You specifically need to be looked at in the context of your marriage and in the context of your finances and in the context of your relationship. And so although I do see many communities that have many more children, nonetheless, we are a community with our own sets of needs and our own sets of situations, and we have to look closely. And we also have to realize that this reality changes. This reality changes. I was talking to one of my rebbeim about this, who remarked that in the era of the Gedolim from the early 1900s, the Rav and Rav Huttner and Rav Moshe and Lubavitcher Rebbe and Rav Ruderman. So if you stop and look, you see what? How many children did the Rav have? Great. How many children did Rav Ruderman have? I think Rav Ruderman had also three. And how many children did Rav Moshe have? Four. And the others had less. You know what they sensed? They sensed raising Orthodox children in the 20s and the 30s was sort of like very hard. And if you wanted to raise them from, you know what you have to do? You have to pay attention every day to each and every one of them. And if you had 11, they weren't going to come out right. You have to have a smaller number. And there was a generation in the 50s and 60s that had many more because they sensed this was the time to have a lot of children. They were making hay while the sun shines. You have to figure out whether you're in a time and a place and a community and a construct where you can make hay while the sun shines without paying close attention to each and every one of your children. And that's a judgment that's very time, place, and effort driven. I was talking to a very well-known halachic authority in Israel who has two non-religious children. And he remarked to me that this is a reflection of the fact he didn't pay close attention to them growing up, thinking that society would raise them. And he looked at me and said, you know what? Society raised them. I have to be very careful about raising children. Children are more complicated to grow than strawberries. And you have to figure out exactly how you're going to go about raising them and in every particular way. So here we've outlined the three fundamental issues with regard to birth control. The first is placing the mitzvah of pruah ravuh in the context of other mitzvot aseh. And like other mitzvot aseh, it's a mitzvah that can be delayed so long as it's fulfilled in the proper time frame. The proper time frame is having as many children as you can, but no less than a boy and a girl. But there's a recognition of the fact that you have to balance having them, which is relatively easy, with raising them, which is relatively hard. If we only have to have children, men would find it absolutely simple and women would find it just a tad more complicated. But the problem is that we have to raise them. We have to balance having them with the needs to raise them. And you have to have a suitable number of children in that context. The second thing we discussed is technical methods of birth control. And I said that the pill is the preferred method of birth control as a matter of halakha, and then I digressed to talk about marital sexuality, noting how important it is that happily married couples have a happy sexual life in our incredibly promiscuous world. Being happily sexually married is important, and I stopped to give you a sense of how the pill can change the cycle of Taras Peshacha in a positive way, at least in the beginning of one's marriage. And then the third thing we spoke about is the hashkafic sense that we are in a time and a place where making hay while the sun shines sounds like a good idea, and it's a good thing to say in general to everybody, but when it comes to giving specific advice to specific people about the proper time, place to have children, you have to give specific advice to specific people, and you have to look at them in the context of their marriage to determine what's the best piece of advice to give them. And you can't just scream out from the bima, make hay while the sun shines, because somebody has to harvest the hay and bundle the hay and keep it all together and make sure that the hay comes out wearing a kippah if it's a boy, and otherwise full of yiras shemayim if it's a girl. And it's very complicated to just make hay, because the hay requires processing and growing and development, and not all of you are privileged enough to be married to as wonderful a woman as I am. So it's just difficult and complicated to do all these things correctly. I'm glad to take questions now. Those of you who have questions that you want to ask in public, you can ask in public. Those of you who want to ask questions in private, you can ask questions in private. Those of you who want my email address is mbroide, mbroyde, at emory.edu. My wife says I'm an incessant email checker, and that it's unpleasant. I maintain I don't check my email enough, and the happy medium is probably somewhere in between. Please, questions?
You very just quickly touched on an issue which I think affects quite a few people, and that's the concept of financial restrictions. Mm. To what extent? I mean, if you read most of the sort of halakhic texts, they finances come really some way down in consideration as to how many children you can have.
It's impossible to answer because finances are individual. When you're living at the border of poverty, so finances play a greater role. When you're living in with a lack of luxury and you want to know if you should lower your luxury a little bit, so they play a greater role. People should be prepared to sacrifice for the sake of their children. But I wouldn't take charity so quickly to have more children than the minimum. I'm sure other halakhic authorities disagree with that. But I think the notion that you can avoid taking charity might itself be grounds to curtail the number of children a person might choose to have.
I've got these conflicting images in my head. At one end of the spectrum, I have a friend who had four children, they put in quick succession, went to her rabbi, and he said, and she had postnatal depression as well, and the rabbi said, no, you can't use contraception, which I think it's a bit extreme. And then, yes, at the other end, I have pictures of, I'm a GP, patients who come to me and, you know, they're in their 30s, they want their career, you know, in their head, sort of their career is more important than their family. So leaving it to the individual to choose when the best time for their, for them to start planning a family, sometimes some women seem to miss the, as you say, miss the boat, miss the
So you're raising a different issue. You're not talking about birth control. You're talking about who's in charge.
Mm.
I don't want to talk too much about who's in charge. You're raising a more general phenomenon, which is the more charedi you get, the more you defer to the rabbi on every different aspect of your life, and the more modern you get, the more independent you become. Maybe that's good. Maybe that's bad. It's a complicated conversation, but not ours. Not ours. This is just phenomenon number 57 in that general issue that you've described, which I suppose we could talk about, but why bother?
The mitzvah of Erev al Chanukah, the mitzvah of having more children after the Peruvu. So I've heard different opinions as to whether it's modeled on the mitzvah of Peruvu, as to whether it fulfills the son and the daughter in the same way that Peruvu is. On the other hand, some other halakhic authorities disagree and hold it's an unlimited either chiyuv or mitzvah.
It's more intuitive to say it's an unlimited chiyuv or mitzvah than it is to say it's modeled on the Tzvun Tzor. The reason why it's more intuitive is because the Shulchan Aruch classifies it that way. Not because I have an intuition, but because I have a text. Texts beat intuition hands down in the rabbinic world.
Forgive me for pretending to say this, but I didn't mean to ask you about the short-term effects of the bill. I was referring to possible critique of the rabbinic approach in that it hasn't necessarily taken women's health in terms of cancer in.
I think it's very small. I mean, if you want to talk science, I'm glad to talk science, but the pill is FDA approved. Its byproduct rate is very small. And of course you can, you know, those people who think that they shouldn't immunize their children are opposed to the pill as well. But I'm not interested in having a serious conversation here about the science.
No, but you will increasingly come across, as people are getting more, you're getting more from women who cover their hair, you know, having doulas in Israel and whatnot, you will see in forthcoming years more women saying, oh, I'm interested in natural family planning, I'm interested in natural this, natural that. And if
you know what, the joke in the United States is, you know what you call people who practice the rhythm method of birth control?
Parents.
Call them parents, that's right. I think that's, I don't want to talk too much about the science. People have to determine the facts as they want to determine the facts. But there's a deep scientific consensus, so to say. You don't have to be part of that consensus, I don't care. But there's still a deep scientific consensus, so to say. You already got the talk. Who has not yet asked the question?
What's the viewpoint of gender selection in relation to fertility?
Look, gender selection is all about how, not what. Abortion as a method of gender selection is a terrible sin. That's the only real way we have nowadays to do gender selection with any degree of seriousness. If we could imagine the Talmudic model where if you looked at a picture of a boy, you had a boy. You look at a picture of a girl, you had a girl. We could have a conversation about gender selection, but the only way to really do gender selection now is either do PGD, which is very expensive, or to do amnio and an abortion, or CVS and an abortion.
Yeah.
There's a lot of IVF, sure. But IVF gender selection is pretty complicated because you have to split the sperm. It's not something people would do naturally. Once you're already selecting for something else, presumably gender selection within reason would be okay. But to go in for PGD just to do gender selection doesn't sound halachically proper. To do gender selection once you're already doing PGD to avoid Tay-Sachs or MS, that would be okay. If you don't know what the term PGD means, tough. Too much to explain right now. It's called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. It's a form of taking many eggs from a woman and fertilizing them in a petri dish, doing a genotype on each and every egg, and implanting the eggs that you want in the woman. If you didn't understand lots of those words, so that's just whatever. Okay, I didn't discuss the relationship between either the pill or the IUD and the practice of Taras HaMishpacha. This is a very serious issue on a very practical level. The truth goes as follows. Different women spot in different ways based both on the pill and on the IUD. This is a very complicated issue, and it requires face time with a rabbi, or if not with a rabbi, with somebody who you're comfortable with. This is a very important issue, but there's no general rule here. Some women spot incessantly from what they call the high estrogen pill. Some women spot incessantly from IUDs. Some women spot incessantly, but only from the copper IUDs. So you're 100% correct, but I couldn't stop to address it without dealing with too many highly particular variables that don't apply to every woman or even most women. And there's definitely a relationship between the method of birth control chosen and Taras HaMishpacha issues, but there are too many variables because women are different. So you're 100% correct. The copper IUD is a much greater Taras HaMishpacha problem than the Mirena, the hormonal IUD. But in truth, even the hormonal IUD produces spotting sometimes, and the low estrogen pills have proven much more easier to deal with the Taras HaMishpacha issues as well. So I guess I should have, with hindsight, spoken a little bit about the relationship between birth control and Taras HaMishpacha, but I just ran out of time. And what I find is as follows. Most women don't want a lecture on this. They want 5 minutes with a Morah Hurah because every person is different. This is an area where every person is different rather than 95% of the women are the same. So I normally don't find it useful to talk about the big picture because there isn't a big picture. There's just a person. And there's just no point in talking about the big picture because the big picture is not a big picture, it's just about me. So I didn't answer this question. You have to, an addition factor in the questions about what color are you spotting. Many women spot from the pill red, but from a Mirena they only spot yellow.
I.e., in general terms, its impact on Taras HaMishpacha doesn't influence the way you would pasken on
that. Of course it does. There are some cases where women have to get off a method of birth control because it's such an effective method of birth control the couple isn't living together at all. That's an effective method of birth control through and through. Now, by the way, it's worth noting here that halacha incredibly frowns on abstinence as a method of birth control between a married couple. It's a wrong and inappropriate and improper. It shouldn't be used as a method of birth control in any way, shape, or form. And a competent Morah Hurah knows that and raises that issue all the time. So, of course, it's an incredibly important issue. I just, having answered lots of these questions, I haven't seen enough general principles to make it worth talking about in public because I can only talk about 500 specific cases rather than three general principles. And I find when I have to talk about 500 cases rather than three general principles, everybody listens to the one case that's them. And the other 499 cases, they just sit there bored out of their mind. So I didn't talk about it, but it's worth noting that if this is an issue, you have to go talk to a competent Mor HaRa. These issues can almost always be resolved if you have a Mor HaRa who's both halachically competent and medically aware. Sometimes you have a Mor HaRa who's halachically competent and not medically aware, in which case you need to find a different one. Sometimes you have a Mor HaRa who's medically aware and not halachically competent, in which case you need to find a different one. Sometimes you're blessed with a rabbi who's bad at both. But good at other things, I'm sure. You are, of course, blessed with a well-known, very Mor HaRa. No. And, you know, communities grow because of the confidence of the rabbi. And, you know, rabbis are no different than anybody else, which is if you treat them nicely and water them regularly and provide them with support and a sense of accomplishment and appreciation, they lead you well. Because there's nothing quite as rewarding as being a rabbi of a kehilah kedosha. And your job as congregants is to continuously persuade the rabbi that you're a kehilah kedosha worthy of his leadership. If you do that, then you end up with a rabbi who believes in you and the community that believes in the rabbi. When that kesher is broken, then you have an employee. But if you keep that connection alive between a rabbi who believes in his kehilah kedosha and a kehilah kedosha who supports his rabbi, that's what it takes to build a dynamic, wonderful synagogue. Thank you very much, and thank you, Rabbi.
Really, heartfelt thanks to Rabbi Breud, not just for those very sweet words at the end, but for a very, very wonderful presentation. I think, just to sum up, a theme that Rabbi Breud made repeatedly is that there's general principles, but the person is very important in that that equation as well. Perhaps the person is the primary importance. So obviously what's said in a shir for 50 people is a principle, and rather not necessarily what's being directed to every individual. Rabbi Breud has very kindly given everybody access to his email address. They're not quite locking up the building yet. If anybody wants a private word with Rabbi Breud, perhaps in the next room, then that's certainly he's available for that as well. Thank you to Rabbi Breud, and thank you to everybody for coming this evening.
Rabbi Michael Mazeltov.
You're going to take me home? No, I'm going to go to the